Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto. Each week, we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in Scripture and what's happening in our lives and in the world. Most weeks, the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time, we're joined by guest preachers. In this sermon from June 21st, 2026, Reverend Harris reflects on Exodus 20, 4 through 6, commonly known as the Second Commandment. This sermon continues the summer series entitled, The 10 Requirements for the Flourishing of God's Kingdom. The Second Commandment or requirement warns against making idols and worshiping them. Reverend Harris explains how the Cranberry song Zombie helps us see that the idols we worship are not usually made of wood or silver or gold. Instead, they're often in our heads.
Hello again, everyone. So in 1993, during the Troubles in Ireland, the Irish Republican Army carried out two bombings in Warrington, England. The first bombing on February 26th resulted in only one injury. The second bombing was on March 20th, and on that day, the IRA had placed two bombs in separate cast iron trash cans in a busy shopping area about 100 yards from each other. The bombs were then detonated about a minute apart, and the second went off near the people who were fleeing from the first. The cast iron bins created extensive shrapnel that increased the damage, injuring 56 people and killing two children. One child was named Jonathan Ball. He was in town that day with a babysitter shopping for a Mother's Day card. The second child was 12-year-old Tim Perry. He experienced severe head injuries, and after 5 days was determined to have minimal brain activity, and they took him off the machines and he died. Not long after that, Dolores O'Riordan, the lead singer of the Irish alternative rock band The Cranberries, was on tour and learned that the group's tour bus was passing by Warrington, where the bombing had recently happened. At the time, Dolores was in her early 20s, and she and the Cranberries were known for their sort of haunting, lilting, soft rock, like Linger and Dream, and of course, her beautiful mezzo-soprano voice. But as she reflected on these bombings as they passed by Warrington, as she thought about the children that had died, and she found that she just couldn't get the images of the violence and the suffering out of her head. And so she started to write a song that was filled with a lot more darkness and anger than a typical Cranberries song. She started playing some chords, she says, and then the repetitive chorus just sort of came out of her. In your head, zombie, zombie, zombie. In your head, zombie, zombie, zombie. And then she started building the verses around that chord and chorus. Another head hangs lowly, child is slowly taken, and the violence caused such silence. Who are we mistaken? But you see, it's not me, it's not my family. In your head, they are fighting with their tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns. In your head, they are crying. Another mother's breaking heart is taking over. When the violence causes silence, we must be mistaken. It's the same old theme since 1916. In your head, they are fighting with their tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns. In your head, they are dying. So you might be wondering what that story about that song has to do with the second requirement, which is the topic of our sermon today. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything in the heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below the earth, you shall not bow down to them or serve them. We might think this requirement is a bit archaic, in fact, easy to follow in this day and age. Do any of us make little statues in the form of people or animals that we then bow down to and worship? Of course not. We don't do that. But if we dig deeper beneath the literal meaning of the second requirement and look honestly at our behavior, we find that we do bow down to images all the time, but as O'Riordan sings, these images are in our heads. We are controlled by our thoughts and emotions, by ideas, by concepts, often without being aware of it, or if we are aware of them, without being able to stop them. There's a contemporary saying that kind of makes light of this. People use it sometimes, you may have heard it. When we think of something all the time, sometimes without even realizing it, people say that that thing, quote, lives rent-free in your head. It can be something harmless, like a song, but it can also be a funny video that you saw or something you heard somebody say, like a witty remark. Those things are said to live rent-free in our heads, and they can be very harmless. But of course, they can also be pretty dark and sinister. I hate to be the one to point this out to you, but our current president lives rent-free in most of our heads. He is just so obnoxious and upsetting and mean and dangerous, while at the same time being this narcissistic megalomaniac with a ton of power. In fact, it may be because he is so base and primitive that he triggers our deepest fears and insecurities and anger. So whether people revere him or despise him, his image lives rent-free in our heads. And so we make him, or we allow him to make himself, an idol. For Dolores O'Riordan, the images of the violence during the Troubles, the bombs going off, the children suffering, the people dying, those images were living rent-free in her head. She doesn't choose that they should be there. In fact, she doesn't want them to be there when she says, "It's not me, it's not me." With her tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns in your head, in your head. Now, people interpret the word zombie in different ways. Some say it refers to the children or the other victims of violence because in real life, they have died, but they continue to be the living dead in our heads when we can't let go of those images. They continue to live because she can't or she couldn't let them go because she kept trying to make sense of this senselessness or to find some kind of like mental drawer where we could put those images in so they stop haunting us. But until then, until we can try to find some peace with them, they're like the living dead inside us. How do we get the zombies out of our head? To compare these idolatrous images to zombies is really not so far from a connection that is made about idolatry in the Bible. In Psalm 115, the psalmist describes what idols are and how they are like living things that are not really living. It says, "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see, ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk. They make no sound in their throats." Idols are like zombies. They are like the living dead. But then the psalmist turns sharply from critiquing the idols themselves to critiquing those who make the idols and worship them. It says, "Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them." The danger of idol worship, whether it is worshiping something made of wood and silver and gold or made of the electrons firing in our brain, is that we become like these images in our head. We become the zombies. And in the last song, O'Riordan changes the chorus to a question. Instead of "in our head," she says, "What's in your head?" So what's in your head? Is it Donald Trump? Is it your boss? Is it your critical mother from the past or currently? Is it your emotionally absent father? Is it someone you trusted who hurt you? Is it someone you love but in an unhealthy way? Is it someone you love who is hurting but you can't help them? Is it a resentment or a grudge? Is it a fear? What takes up your psychic energy? What controls your thinking and behavior? The more we let them control us, the more we become like them, lifeless zombies. And remember, these 10 requirements are all about liberation. They're all about being free from slavery, being free to be ourselves, to be who we were created to be, free to love ourselves, to love others, to love God, free to be alive, to not be zombies going through life without seeing or hearing or touching or feeling, because we're always in our heads. These requirements invite us to be free to live a new life. And in some ways, the second requirement is just an expansion of the first. You will have no other gods before this God who sets you free. And every other god besides the one who liberates us is a god that imprisons us. Every other god besides the living God is a lifeless thing. Every other god will suck our life out of us and make us zombies. The first and second requirements are really just two sides of the same coin. But there is something that distinguishes the second requirement from the first. And that is, there are consequences given for not following the second requirement. And there is a reward offered for following it. This idea that God will punish children for the sins of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who make and worship idols. And God will show steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love God and keep God's requirements. But how disturbing is that? What kind of God punishes innocent children for the mistakes of their parents? It's so counter to what we think is fair that it may cause us to reject this description of God entirely, and I think that would be a reasonable choice. And I honestly don't know what to do with that idea theologically, but what I do know is it's a pretty good description of generational trauma. Generational trauma is this very real thing backed up by sociology and psychology and epigenetics that most of us carry at least some emotional wounds inflicted on us by our parents, probably passed on to them by their parents. And we hold that wounding from our childhood. Even as we know that our parents were acting out lessons or hurt that they experienced, and even as we intentionally try to avoid the same mistakes with our children, the cycle just keeps going. It's powerful stuff. But no child, despite that reality, no child deserves to be hurt by a loved one. Certainly no child deserves physical abuse. No child deserves to be a witness to abuse. No child deserves to be afraid of their drunk parent. No child deserves to become a surrogate parent for their absentee parent. No child should be relentlessly criticized or demeaned by an insecure parent. And beyond family systems, trauma is passed along by society as well. No child deserves to be raised in poverty. No child deserves to be discriminated against or deserves to be afraid of a soldier or a police officer killing their family or of bombs blowing up their homes. And no child deserves to live through a genocide. And yet one or more of these familial or social traumas happen to most children in this world. So the idea of children being punished for their sin, the sins of their parents, is a terrible description of God, but it's a really good description of life. One of my favorite sayings about generational trauma is that if you don't face your demons, they will raise your children. Or in terms of our topic today, we become the things that live in our heads. So the punishment is real, even if we don't attribute it to God. And at the same time, there is also in this requirement a remarkable offering of hope, that if we can abide by these requirements and be liberated from these things in our heads, we can break the cycles of generational trauma. And that's a huge promise. And it's not just for one generation either, but it's for the second and the third and the fourth. If we can work on our behaviors and heal from our wounds, we can have a positive impact even to the thousandth generation to come. What a remarkable claim. And to find that path toward healing, we can turn back to the first requirement. Because we may not be able to exorcise all of the harmful gods that fight to control us, but we can consciously choose which one we want to elevate, which one we want to follow and to obey and to love. We can identify that one God who sets us free, who gives us life each day, that one God that we can put above all other gods in our thoughts, in our words, and in our actions. The spiritual teacher Ram Dass often said that after years of meditation and spiritual practice that he had done, he had not managed to get rid of a single one of his neuroses. But because of that lifetime of spiritual work, these neuroses were no longer powerful monsters in his head. Instead, he said they'd become little schmooze. They were like little schmooze. So his anger was a little schmoo, and his resentment and his lust and his fears became little schmooze, and his pettiness, all of that, because of the work that he had done, they'd lost their power over him. They became less like gods and more like little schmooze. And that's the goal. Make all other gods in our heads into little schmooze. Have no other gods before God. That work of healing will be different for all of us. Prayer, meditation, therapy, somatic work, support groups, time in nature, service, reading, study. Each of us will have to find our own path. But one component of the work is critical, despite whatever path we choose, and that is that it has to happen in relationship. It has to happen in the context of community. We haven't gotten to requirements 5 through 10 yet, but they're all about how we treat each other. And none of those requirements were given to a single person. They were all given to a people, to a community. They don't work in isolation. So, beware of the zombies in your head, the lifeless idols that control you and suck your life away. And then in your thoughts and prayers and words and actions, lift up those ideals, those things, that God who is life-giving and liberating. Do the work every day, intentionally and consciously, knowing that failure has consequences for those that we love the most, our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But success, the success of making the demons into little schmooze, brings blessings to those very same people and to generations beyond that that we can't even imagine. The stakes are very high. What's in your head? Amen.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.